Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm amazed actually to be sitting across from Jodie Pico, I've been selling her books for all of my bookselling career, and now we are delighted to have her with us here at Booktopia talk about her new book, Small Great Things. Welcome, Jodie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I also am a little aware that you do podcasts extremely well yourself. No pressure on me. I've been listening to them the last few days, knowing that I was. And I shouldn't have done that.
Now you're feeling a lot of pressure.
I'm feeling the
it's
pressure.
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. Don't worry. It's gonna go fine.
Your new book is like a sort of a ticking time bomb for our own personal prejudices. I feel, because when I talk about our own, it's almost an exact example of what you're trying to undermine. Casual privileged position that wealthy white nations have and don't know they really have.
Right.
And through the power of fiction, you in this novel slowly lead us to see it. I've read that this book has had a long germination. What was it? What was the key that allowed it to actually come out?
So I started writing, or wanted to start writing, about racism about 25 years ago. I was living in New York City. There was a real-life news story about an African-American undercover cop who was shot 4 times in the back by a white colleague. And I really wanted to use that at the heart of a novel. And I tried, and I failed miserably. I could not seem to create authentic voices, authentic situations, and I really second-guessed myself. You know, I'm a white woman. I have grown up with privilege. Really, did I even have the right to write about racism? What on earth could I possibly contribute to the conversation? And I put it aside, and over the years, I'd play devil's advocate with myself and say, okay, now hang on a second. You write all the time as people you're not. You write as school shooters and Holocaust survivors and men, and you're never going to be any of those things either. So why was this different? Well, it's because racism's different. You know, we don't like to talk about it because we're afraid we're going to offend people. And as a result, we actually are stifled and paralyzed and don't have the conversation at all. So then fast forward to 2012, and again I stumble across another real-life news story. Came out of Flint, Michigan. An African-American nurse with 20 years of experience on a labor and delivery ward delivered a baby, and in the aftermath, the father called her supervisor in and said, "I don't want her or anyone who looks like her to touch my kid." And he pushed up his sleeve to reveal a swastika tattoo. The hospital put a post-it note on the baby's file saying, "No African-American personnel to touch this baby." The nurse wound up suing the hospital, settled out of court. I hope she got a huge settlement, big payback. But it made me wonder, what if it had not gone down like that?
Yeah.
What if I could push the envelope and use this as the nugget of a story? What if that nurse had been the only one alone in a room with a baby when something went wrong and she had to choose between following her supervisor's orders or saving a baby's life? What if, as a result, she wound up on trial, defended by a white public defender who, you know, like me, like a lot of people I know, would never say she was a racist? What if I could tell the story in the points of view of that African-American nurse, that white public defender, and the white supremacist father, as they all began to examine their beliefs about power and privilege and race? And once I sort of hit that hurdle, I cleared that, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be able to write this. And it was because two things had changed: my intent and my audience. I wasn't writing a book about racism to tell people of color how hard their lives are. I mean, let's face it, I'm never going to be able to tell that story. And I'm not the one who should tell it. There are so many amazing writers of color who are doing a fabulous job of that already. I was writing to the people who look like me, the people who can point to a white supremacist and say, oh, that's a racist, but have a much harder time pointing to themselves and doing the same exact thing. And yet, that's exactly what white people need to do, because racism isn't just about prejudice. It's also about power. And in America and in a lot of countries, if you have light-colored skin, you have all the power, which means even if you're not talking about racism, you are still part of the problem.
Yeah. It strikes me, just as you're saying that last part, that it's a very similar problem between men and women, that in the sense of that it's so institutionalized that it is almost impossible to see.
And implicit racism, which is kind of what you're hinting at, is you know, it's the point that everybody has bias. You can't help it. A terrific racial justice educator whose name is Beverly Daniel Tatum describes it as the smog in the air. So it's all around us and we don't even realize we're breathing it in. And it's not just targeted direct racism towards a person of color. It's the fact that the world as we know it is a pretty white world. Mm. It's that when you open a magazine, the standard of beauty is white. When you go to a drugstore and you want to buy a Band-Aid, the flesh color is your flesh color.
Yeah.
When you go to look for a greeting card that has a family on the front, the families all look like our families and not families of color. All those tiny little things begin to add up. And what's interesting about implicit bias is that even people of color will have implicit bias towards white people because that's how they've grown up.
Yeah.
You know, the real question isn't, are we biased? Because we all are.
Yeah.
The real question is, knowing that we have these privileges, now what are you going to do with that?
Yeah. So with this book, I've heard you speak about the power of fiction to entertain and educate.
Yes.
At the same time. And as a writer of fiction that wants to be read to the end,
mm-hmm.
you have to have that balance so finely tuned because you don't want to be lecturing
right.
your reader. And is that is by using the different characters you've used in this book, is that your mechanism of being able to do that, to have that contrast when you flick between these two characters' perspectives?
100%, because yeah. Like you said, I don't want to inflict my viewpoint on a reader. What I try to do when I use multiple voices and when I'm talking about a controversial situation is to use each of those voices to show a different facet of the situation.
Mm.
So, for example, when you listen to Turk, the character in Small Great Things who is a skinhead, a white supremacist, he's awfully heinous.
Mm.
And, of course, the information that I am relaying to you came from research that I did with two former white supremacists. Everything that happens in Turk's perspective happened to one of them. And just to give you an example, I cut 80 pages of Turk's narrative.
Yeah.
There was a lot more that could have happened, and you'll be very rattled reading it. You know, and if you are a white person who comes to this book, I think that's going to be your first immediate reaction. Oh, I can't stand Turk. Oh, I'm nothing like Turk.
But I think you underestimate your power as a storyteller, because when you do get in with the character, Ripley is one of the examples that I always use in my head. Talented Mr. Ripley.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, we barrack for this psychopath.
Right. Well, and that's it. You know, what happens to Turk, it's worth saying, as heinous as he is, as heinous as his viewpoints are, you're going to feel empathy for him.
Mm.
Because the worst thing in the world that has happened to him, you know, in my opinion, losing a child, is something that we all can relate to.
Yeah.
And so you're going to immediately feel that discord in your own head.
Mm.
The second time that you'll feel discord is when you begin to realize that Kennedy, who is the white attorney, you know, who has spent her life defending people of color because that tends to be her clientele, who would never say, I'm a racist, someone who you probably see a little of yourself in. You know, there's a certain point in the book where you kind of go, oh my gosh, wait, I actually am like her too.
Yeah.
And Kennedy has a sea change as well as she begins to understand that, you know, like I said, racism is power plus prejudice. And it's not just enough to point to the prejudice and call that out. You know, you could take every white supremacist in the world and ship him off to Mars and you would still have racism.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Well, because there's more to it than that. You know, and ultimately, like you said, racism is systemic and institutional and messy and big and overwhelming. But it's both dismantled and enhanced by individual acts.
Mm. When I read this, and I'm proud of the novel when I read this, because it is a form that is so detailed and can be so subtle and is so flexible,
mm-hmm.
To be able to flip between the two points of view, to be able to express very forcefully
mm-hmm.
the opposite idea to one you hold, and then make you fall in line with the absolute opposite of that again,
right.
within pages.
But also what I think is critical about the novel is that it's a beautiful vehicle to discuss an extremely controversial subject.
Mm.
Look, most people are not on a day-to-day basis going to go out and say, I'm going to go pick up the latest academic treatise by a social justice educator.
Yeah.
You might if you're in college or in a PhD program, but most of us are not reading those books unless we have to.
Yeah.
Novels are meant to be entertainment. And you can come to a novel with someone whose opinions are completely different from yours. And instead of getting up in someone's face and saying, so I think you're a racist, which is not going to go well, FYI, you can say, hey, let's read this book together. And you start talking, oh, you know, when this happened to Ruth, when this happened to Kennedy, I could really relate because blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And eventually it can segue into, you know, this reminds me of something I saw on the news. And you wind up having a very organic conversation about a very difficult topic. Fiction is a springboard into a difficult conversation. And that's why I love it as a vehicle.
Yeah, because it is because of that, the shades of gray that are in there.
Right.
I'm not talking about that horrible book, but the shades of that are in there, they're on every single idea.
Mm-hmm.
A good novelist will never give you black and white. It
right.
just has to be.
Even no
if
pun
you,
intended.
Even if, it, yeah, even if you're looking at first glance at an opening of a book,
right?
You may have these perceptions in your head, and then slowly,
mm-hmm.
As you do in this novel, undermine those
right,
and make you question them, so that you are wandering off. And we spoke before going on the podcast. One of my colleagues was talking about having read the proof copy. And one of the, I think, the greatest compliments anyone give a novelist is that they're still thinking about the book months later.
I've heard that from so many people who read it as an advanced copy. I'm still hearing from people who, it came out in America, you know, 4 weeks ago, and people who are still thinking about it, people who experience a moment in their daily lives and the book flashes in front of their eyes and they realize they have to catch themselves on their own behavior or their own words. That, to me, is why I wrote this book. The whole point of this was to get the people who look like me to address racism, to make it part of the conversation. When I was doing the research for this book and I was working with multiple women of color, I sat down for over 100 hours of interview tape with them. And they were very gracious to me because they overlooked the fact that I knew nothing about their lives and really taught me a lot and became my sensitivity readers of the manuscript as well, so that Ruth's voice could be as accurate and real as possible, and they could correct me when I was wrong. One woman was a mom, and she said to me, how often do you talk about racism with your kids? And I said, oh, you know, I mean, when things happen on the news, and she went, mm-hmm, I talk about racism every night because it's a matter of life and death.
Yeah.
You know, and even that, just that smack in the face, that metaphorical smack that makes you realize not talking about this stuff is a total privilege.
Mm.
You know, yeah. Most of us don't think about racism because we don't have to. But if my son were 15 years old and was black, I'd be thinking about it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had a similar situation years ago. I left Australia and was living in London. I was thrown into a company of a whole range of people from a whole range of backgrounds. And I had a very privileged life in Sydney. And to come up against it. And it wasn't until one of them got really frustrated at me and just went, you can never know. Like, mm-hmm. just reached across and said,
right.
You can't know.
Right.
You know, I was raised in Turkey, but this mm-hmm. is my early life, and that doesn't give you anything
right.
about what it is to be
no.
from the other side.
No, and I never will know. I mean, I can listen and try to learn, which I think is really our role
yeah.
as an ally, but I will never really know. And one of the things that I've been saying a lot on this tour is, look, I hope that when you read Ruth, she feels authentic, and it's been a tremendous gift to me that so many readers of color have written to say, I had to make sure that you were white because this was very similar to my life, and here are the microaggressions that I've faced, and you know, and they're sharing their stories with me, but they really feel a resonance in Ruth, which makes me feel really good, like I did my homework well.
Yeah.
But ultimately, what I keep telling people is, one of the highest compliments you could give me is to finish Small Great Things and then go look at your bookshelf. And ask yourself, are you reading authors of color in the same percentage that you are reading white authors? And if not, why not?
Yeah.
You know, because if you're not, you're missing out on some of the most amazing literature that's out there. And if we only read the people who look and sound like us, we're never going to grow. If you really want to know what it's like to be black in America, don't ask me.
Yeah.
Go read someone like Colson Whitehead, you know,
yeah.
or Jessamyn Ward or Jacqueline Woodson, amazing storytellers who can talk to that experience with authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, I really do hope that this book inspires people to go out and listen to voices of color that may not have been heard before.
We are speaking in a period of doubt at this moment. We don't know whether anyone's going to be able to listen to this because the world may have ended.
It's entirely possible. It can happen in 2 hours. Yeah.
if things go the wrong way in the election. But on a positive note, we believe that there will be a tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, it's already tomorrow in Australia. I feel good about that.
um, in the environment that America right now, with the Black Lives Matter movement, a growing disenfranchisement of the people and wealth of black, white, I almost feel like the election needed this book a little bit earlier to help people start thinking.
To be completely honest, we are so election crazy in the United States that I'd be shocked if anyone even notices I published a book recently. It's been a very tough run up to this election. And, you know, even here in Australia, I'm slavishly refreshing my news feed to see what's going on. But I believe that the Trump candidacy has given hate speech a place in the mainstream, which, having researched with white supremacists, is absolutely terrifying. I know so much more than you should ever want to.
Yeah, well, I don't want
to. Yeah, and honestly, you know, to know that white supremacists have actually come out and endorsed this man, that's very frightening. You know, and no matter who wins the election, they're still there.
Yeah, we're getting a bit of it here. I don't know if you've anyone's informed you here, but our parliament is being filled up with people who have very extreme views right now.
And there is a fragmentation in the political system of America, and there's a lot that's broken there. I mean, we're an amazing country, and I believe we're full of incredible people who really do work better together. I think what we're seeing is the last gasp of a dying white patriarchy, and I would like to believe it's going to end, tonight.
In your podcast, you describe your early success, and you do suggest that Australia was one of the first countries to pick up on the power of Jodi Picoult writing.
Absolutely. It was, It was actually a great place because I had not been published in England and Australia for probably like the first 7 or 8 years of my career, when nobody knew who I was in America anyway. When things hit very quickly in the UK, that was also when I got an Australian publisher. I've worked with Allen and Unwin exclusively. I love them.
Yeah.
They're a terrific company. And they made me very much a household name in Australia. I mean, I love Australian readers. You're very fierce and passionate, which is what any writer wants. There has to be a reason that I've come here like 7 or 8 times. Nobody wants to make that flight that many times if you're not having a good reception. So, you know, it really has been a very lovely audience for me. I'm really grateful to the readers here, and the fact that they are just as excited and passionate about upcoming books of mine as, you know, readers on my side of the world.
When I first opened, I had a secondhand bookshop for years, and when I first opened my bookshop, I had two books that were the ones that I always had to have on the shelf, and one was Tully, but the other one was The Pact. And if I had ever had any sort of writer who was
I remember Tully. What a great book. Yeah.
So they were, any writer that was sort of, I don't know what to go.
Right. Oh, he tried this.
Yeah, bang. And it always come back. Talking about The Pact. And then the great thing was that soon after the success of that, your other books got published in Australia. And so there was other things for the reader to go on with.
Right,
But you really took, in the Australian market, you kind of made a new area of fiction that was a thought-provoking. Mm-hmm. You took a theme, a subject which was gnawing at you or distressing you in some way, and then explored it.
It's moral and ethical fiction. Yeah. I mean, I get asked to describe, you know, what do you write all the time, and I actually hate that question because, actually in Australia, for reasons I don't understand, I was considered a crime writer for a long time. I still remember going to the Sydney Writers Festival and being on a crime writers panel, and someone asked me a question. I said, I don't know, because I don't write crime. I don't know why I'm here. It was very, very strange.
It's probably one of those moments when they're reaching out to it, because the Writers Festival has a certain bent.
Right.
And it's probably, let's reach out to some of these genre writers.
Yeah, it was so very strange. Yeah. I mean, I don't like to pigeonhole, because there are people who read me who only read mysteries. There are people who read me who only read literary fiction and who only read, you know, women's fiction. And 48% of my fan mail comes from men. So I don't like being pigeonholed, but I would say that it's moral and ethical fiction, and I would love to say that I invented it, but I'm sure that Charles Dickens would disagree with you, or, you know, it's been done for a long time.
Yeah.
It just wasn't being done very much when I started doing it in the early 90s.
Well, it tied up very nicely with the rise of the book club.
Yes, it actually worked out really well, because when the wine runs out, you actually do have to talk about some things.
Yeah, and these are meaty subjects for people to get into.
And, I mean, I'm really excited. I've had a lot of book clubs do small great things. And, I mean, talk about a weighted and fraught discussion. It's quite an interesting
very
set of confessions. Yes.
It would be a very confronting episode of their...
Absolutely. I mean, there are discussion questions actually on my website for this book that were written by a social justice educator for just that reason.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And also, I need to thank you because I noticed on your website that you linked to our 10 terrifying questions, which were given to you many years ago.
But I love them. I always save the really good interviews, so that's a great one.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been such a great opportunity to have you sitting across from us having a chat.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
All of Jodie's books are available on booktopia.com.au right now, but especially for Christmas, Small Great Things is a perfect present. So put one in your shopping cart right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.